So I'm honored to be able to speak. It's a very interesting and an enjoyable program. I've really learned a lot here. In the spirit of what we're trying to do here, I'm going to really try to bridge the two worlds here as best I can, between galaxy and star formation. And my topic here of research is being done with my two PhD students, Mikhail Kloss and Corey Howard, who will be here next week. Samantha Benincasa, who is my undergraduate under thesis, working with James Wadsley, my colleagues at McMaster, Harrison Wadsley, and then my German collaborators, Ralph Kuiper, Thomas Peters, Roby Banerjee, Elizabeth Tasker, and Helen Kirk in Victoria. And the idea of my talk is very simple. I really want to examine two different scales, really, that are vastly different in physical scale and their impact, perhaps, on star formation and the galaxy. So I'm talking about going from galaxies to GMCs to clusters, trying to draw out what's really very important ideas on these different scales. We're going to talk about our simulations on GMC formation, a particular project we've done and published, and linking that to observed catalogs of GMC properties. Then we're talking feedback on two scales. One is on the GMC scale. What does a cluster do to its environment? What does it do to the GMC, therefore shutting off its own source of gas for its formation? And then on a deeper, on a smaller scale yet, individual stars, how they form on the cluster scale at fractions of a parsec. And if I still have time for this, there's been some new methods that we've introduced throughout, including a new hybrid flash AMR code, which is Mikhail Kloss's thesis work, which is just coming into being as I speak in terms of simulations we're starting. So just very general remarks first to set the stage. If we look on the galactic scales, this is dominated by filamentary structure, which has been put there by a variety of types of shock processes here in the interstellar medium, a cross-cut view here, this Canadian Galactic Plane Survey, which if you've never looked at the data, I highly recommend it, in which you can see blown out super bubbles, evidence of chimneys, a variety of structure in this, indicating the feedback processes of various kinds on the interstellar medium. It's the topic of this conference. Probably isn't a better view of the interstellar medium than this one for understanding this observationally. If you now dive down into micro cloud scales, much smaller than this, and say to the Orion region, so here are many degrees on the sky, the entire Orion Nebula is across this whole scale. This is molecular gas, the Orion A and Orion B clouds, for those of you that don't work on star formation. It's where star formation people spend a lot of their time thinking. And if you zoom down on this many tens of parsec scales, down into 10 parsec scale, you see the integral filaments cluster region here, which is around which is the Orion Nebula cluster forming in there. So scale, down to scale, down to scale, dominated by filamentary gas and a variety of feedback processes. Let's look at some GMCs. These are two surveys we're going to use to compare our own numerical catalogs with. So this was the Heyerdahl survey. This is the Boston University Five College Radio Observatory survey completed a number of years ago, 2009. This is a very high resolution look at molecular gas clouds in the galaxy. This is the previous study over here, the famous survey done in 1987 by Solomon et al. Those of you familiar with this survey can see the vast improvement in going from CO12 to 13 CO at much higher sensitivity, et cetera, which is these 13 CO maps shown here for three different clouds. And you can see right from the get-go that you resolve this kind of patchy stuff into definite filamentary structure that's lumpy, but definitely this filamentary structure is obvious on the GMC type of a scale. If you look at this, these maps also found an interesting result that there's quite a range of column densities here for these regions. So unlike the kind of data that was available to Richard Larson when he looked at Larson's relation systematics for GMCs, this is a very narrow range of column density. So that narrow range suggested column density was rather constant. If you open up the box now at high resolution, high sensitivity, you see there's a wide range of column densities of molecular clouds. And this is changing our thinking about how these Larson's relations, one of them at least, works. Let's look at...
Concerning this point, there is Alpes recently, who actually basically confirmed that clouds have no relative because the column density.
Yeah, I'm aware that there's a debate, but.
I guess this is structured inside GMCs, or is it really different GMCs?
I don't know which survey that they used.
It's obviously that,
yeah.
I mean, it's obvious that in a cloud you have a whole range of common density.
Right, but these are the clouds in the higher catalog, yeah. So done by this 13CO method. So
you can see what just broke patterns.
Yes, yeah.
So
yeah.
Broken regions inside GMCs, but you also use
cross-zero. That's right, and there's a difference in just in what you're picking up. That's the important. You have to you know what you're picking off when you use different types of observations and interpret Larson's relations. Exactly. This is M33. So here, whereas the previous catalog had 0.2 parsec resolution, here at M33 you've got a resolution in 13CO of about 20 parsecs. So everything, of course, looks blobbier. This is a selection out of their catalog here, a number of different clouds. You can see some of them are still elongated and blobby, but that data here suggests to the authors that these clouds, they feel, aren't being made by agglomeration-type processes, but rather by instabilities, for example, a tumor instability. So since we've been talking a lot about MHD in this, I thought I'd want to show this slide in which we're seeing the dense gas and magnetic field on the largest scales we're talking about put together. So this is really beautiful work now, coming out of papers like Beck et al. And his collaborators over many years. And as a review here by Heason et al., in which you see large-scale magnetic fields somewhat associated with a spiral structure. In some other maps, you'll see that there's not a, that the peak of the map, the magnetic structure lies in the interarm region. So that's a different kind of a global dynamo operating. This is a map in which a compressive process must be at work in this dynamo mode here. If you look at the field strengths of these now, they've been made. This is beautiful work because you can get the total magnetic field, not only the line of sight. Polarization and rotation measure maps together give you the combined field, both components. And using that, the calculations, the data shown over here, show that the total field then is of order 17 microgauss, and that value means the fields, you have an equipartition now between the ISM cosmic rays and magnetic fields on these large galactic scales. Okay. So let's dive inside a GMC now to the denser gas and look at what is, to the observers, a major revolution. I think theorists always suspected that this is going to be true, that molecular clouds devolve into a series of filaments. To zeroth order, that's their structure. Okay. Herschel observations made this very clear, and there's a long series of papers, and there's an absolute ferment in this literature as more and more teams, you know, key up to do various aspects of filamentary cloud structure studies. Important thing for our talk about star formation here is that these blue regions are what we call cores, dense regions of gas density 10 to the 4 per centimeter cube and larger spatial scale, much less 0.04 parsecs, tiny. This is where individual stars form. These individual stars are all associated, you see, with filaments. Now, this contouring is done in a particular way. White here is a mass per unit length of the filament that exceeds a critical value, which is this, twice the sound speed squared over g. Okay? The virial theorem and any kind of analysis shows that for purely isothermal gas, this is the critical mass per unit length above which you will fragment gravitationally. This has nothing, this does not behave at all like a Bonner-Ebert sphere. Bonner-Ebert sphere, if you press it, if you put high enough pressure on it, it will ultimately collapse. If you take a filament below this critical value, you can squeeze it as much as you want, it will not collapse. Okay. 2D versus 1D gravity are different. Filaments have this very, very simple gravitational. We looked at studies involving magnetic fields. If you've got turbulence, this includes the virial, the thermal, the turbulent velocity squared as well in that calculation. So, the mass function of those cores I just showed you in the previous slide. Again, this is elementary for star formation people. It's the way we think about most things. But Christoph talked about this in his talk. If you can compare that mass function, which is over here, here's log of the mass, number of per unit mass in the mass bins, and here's the Chabrier IMF, you'll see that these two are offset by a factor of about 3. And the origin of this is a topic of interesting discussion, particularly concerns us at this meeting, because that could be a consequence of feedback by a variety of means, either by outflows or perhaps by radiation fields or something. Again, I'm going to now show you magnetic data on this scale, on the filament cluster scale. And this, too, has been a revolution, because here, things like the submillimeter array have come online and will be joined shortly by ALMA, which will turn getting a few vectors per year into a major industry. It'll be the way, as just as common way of taking data as spectral lines will be. Okay, so get prepared to see lots of maps like this. Here is the South Serpent cluster formation region, small little region. These are the stars forming in this cluster region. Here you see they're strongly associated with the filament. You see the magnetic field lines seem to be somewhat perpendicular to the filament, and here with the many vectors added, and with the Herschel spire across this whole region. Very detailed information here.
Do you understand why they should be perpendicular?
Yeah, there's a lot of thought about this. It looks as if the dense gas, when gas is sufficiently dense, then the filament is perpendicular to the sense of the magnetic field, as it is here. However, for wispy, diffuse gas, say up off of here, the field lines and the filaments are parallel. That has something to do with basic physics, we think. Hasn't been tracked down entirely yet, but it's an interesting topic of research. If you look then at field strengths, Zeeman measurements now becoming more plentiful show you that in the scales we're talking about here, clump scales, cluster forming scales, this is the density of the gas. This is the magnetic field strength. This line is basically when the magnetic energy density equals the gravitational energy density in the region you're looking at. That's the mass to flux ratio. That ratio is typically 2 to 3 times the average value of the measured field in the cores. Okay. So magnetic field is there. It's significant. Can't be ignored. It's not dominant. All of this fits beautifully to the advances in computation. So the star formation business underwent a radical revolution in the 1990s, the advent of computer simulations, which people started to investigate effects of turbulence for the first time. And they showed that turbulence, the highly dynamic way of producing filaments, sheets, shocks, filaments, and then clumped the star particles shown along here, the sink particles in this simulation, all suggested that turbulence plays a major role in producing this filamentary structure that's now been clearly observed. So this is really a kind of a triumph. This replaces the static theory of star formation that had been in place in which you looked at magnetized supported equilibria. I've done a great deal of mathematical work on these. The dominated literature in the 80s and 90s replaced this with very dynamic view of star formation processes. There's no reason why this cloud formed in this way has to linger for more than a few crossing times in order for star formation to be completed and everything dissipated away. So let's dig down and take a look. We went through galaxy GMC scales. Let's look at the cluster scales now. So here, it's pretty clear that stars only form, the average density of molecular cloud is 100 particles per centimeter cubed. We're now densities of 10 to the 4 is where you start to see the stars show up. There's many reviews and discussions of this in the literature. Moreover, more than 90% of the stars, when you associate them with clusters or not, most of them form in groups of at least 100 members and greater. So if you look at the efficiencies of star formation, then on the molecular cloud scale, they're of course very low, a few percent. If you look in the dense gas, however, it's 20 to 30%. So we found the factory, if you will. The star formation rates for a whole cloud now would be 10 to the minus 6 to the minus 2 solar masses per year, and this varies. If you're in a region like Orion A that I just showed you, which think of Orion as the median cloud in the distribution of molecular clouds in the galaxy. So Orion is the median cluster. So the rates here between a lower mass cloud and the higher mass clouds in the continuum vary in this way, simply because there's much more gas mass available in the larger clouds.
Wow, so the 20-30% is at the clump scale? So like
this is the clump.
That's
the clump. Yeah. A few parsecs. A parsec and less, yes. And this is the whole GMC. Okay? Important to keep these separated. In other words, clumpy gas is a very small fraction of the total mass of a GMC. And we don't understand that exact number, why that should be. Okay? Although we have scaling laws, so which I'm coming to next. So Mike Fall gave a very nice talk in, during our workshop on this topic. We got particularly, I got very interested in this talk, actually 20 years ago. It's maybe the first time I talked about this subject, actually, in 1994. In a conference, but there is an amazing similarity in property scaling relations between GMCs, clumps, and clusters. It's now very well understood in literature and measured. And for us, this was kind of first time I think anybody had looked at this. But there's a smooth continuum of properties, and as Mike emphasized in this talk, I mean, there's no real difference cluster to cluster. If you go from 100 stars to 10 to the sixth, there's a mass function that's common. The GMCs that they form out have that kind of scaling, as well as the clump mass distribution. Now, the typical numbers are dn by dm is about minus 1.7 power. Some people have argued if it's fractal and self-similar, it's minus 2 power. The more details, I think, show it really is less than 2. So it really is slightly more power and importance to star formation in the most massive clumps in the galaxy than in the small ones by this phenomenal observation. On the basis of this scaling relation, we went out and predicted that actually globule clusters, the extreme end of this cluster sequence, should be formed in 10 to the 8th solar mass clouds, which we called supermassive GMCs. And these, in fact, have been discovered in the antennae by Christine Wilson and their collaborators. So connecting to galaxy simulations now, as best I understand them, Andre and Gnedden and collaborators, and I'm sure there's much of work in this field, but here in galactic simulation, formation simulation, you see the end again, these very dense spiral type structures and disk. The size of the circle goes together with the mass of the globular cluster they found formed, I guess, in a pixel, is that right? You're really on a few pixel scale here. And anyway, that's the data. It's at minus 2 power. OK, let me take the next step now and look just at simulations that we've been doing on GMC formation. And this is work published last year. As you all know, I think, hydro simulations of formation of molecular clouds and galaxies, there's a variety of studies that have been done on this. Local scale projects in which you aim two streams at one another, trying to mimic maybe what's happening in a spiral arm as converging flows come together. There's a veritable industry that's set up in examining the consequences of these colliding flows. They splash, they produce clumps that had many GMC-like properties that I won't talk about here. There's global scale simulations where you've got tumor instabilities operating to fragment and form GMCs. A variety of authors here working on this. And our work follows along this kind of line of thinking here, in which you see inside a fixed gravitational potential of about 10 to the 10 solar masses or so, imposing a co-rotation radius here. This looking in the co-rotating frame, which is imposed here at about 6 kiloparsecs away, as a way of reducing the numerical noise, the effects of rotation on fluffing out the cloud, et cetera, that you get in a Cartesian grid here. And zooming in on this scale, this is a 1 kpc scale and then a few hundred parsecs, you can see that this is a numerical trick that really allows you to increase your resolution inside a global simulation. much the trick that planet formation people use in their disks, actually. And you can see here that there are tidal interactions between clouds that are creating long filaments. These are not the short things in Herschel. These are now, 90, 100 parsecs long, okay? Of which there is separate evidence. I haven't talked about that yet, but there are some very long filaments, long known in the galaxy, that maybe that has something to do with. So high-rise simulations here. So let's take a look at a few clouds in this co-rotating ring. This is not huge simulation resolution these days, where fire gets down to, I guess, one parsec resolution scale in these. But we had been working one parsec and found it very difficult to do, at least in ENSO. So unfortunately, I have nothing to show on that front. But this interstellar medium is heated by the photoelectric effect, as studied by Tasker in her work over the years. These clouds are, the cooling curve function comes down to only 300 degrees. It's left there because clouds are prepared and supported by this. If you think of this, I think of it as a proxy for a turbulent pressure of 1.8 kilometer per second stirring of the gas, which would be just about right. Of course, these are not the same thing, so I just want to emphasize that. It's a device. And so we see here that this is a box size with five clouds being shown. The red here is gas that is at 10 to the 4. Okay? So this should be your cluster-forming gas. This is very low resolution, so there's much more of this than there should be. Okay? But...
Just a question on the...
Yeah.
Yeah. Means
for
the
stars. Yeah, for the galaxy. You just set up. Yes, of course. And you set up a disk spiral galactic potential. It's not an active dark matter halo the way many people use, okay? It's really a toy.
Just a comment
on that.
So I remember when we did something similar also a few years ago in the Everett Cloud paper. I was always under the impression that all the clouds that we were forming are rapidly rotating, like mini disks.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
There is a sense of rotation in molecular clouds. Yes, there is.
Is that so high at scale? Because they look like flat objects in here.
Indeed. Yeah. And
so
they do have that aspect. They're a bit fluffy. I'm not sure how thin yours were, but they're definitely flattened for sure. And joined by, I'll show you kind of a movie of this.
In case of no feedback or other pressure support, something to break.
Right, right. Just to note that, of course, to bring in the MHD element to this always, of course, there's an entire MHD strand of thinking about how you form GMCs, originating with the ideas of Parker instabilities. A magnetic field, as we discussed so far, is buoyant in a fluid. It'll rise up, and material will fall back and drain back to the galaxy along these kiloparsec scale field lines. The idea is that it would gather into gas pockets that become self-gravitating. This was worked out analytically by Elmgreen in 82. You see a growth time scale of order a few million, tens of millions of years in this kind of work. And then more recently, in magnetized gas, in active simulations, it resolved the MRI. A variety of papers here, many authors sitting right here, on the importance of MRN stability in creating initial fluctuations. You don't need a density wave to kick the gas. You get this from the MRI turbulence, and then the amplifier picks it up, and amplifies it by gravitational effects to quite massive clouds in here. I love this, I heart molecular clouds kind of image here. So. So our own catalog is here. You can actually poke around, and it's an online catalog of about over 50 clouds. Here is the zoo of possibilities shown here, where there's several clouds shown in each of these. They don't form this way. They don't form directly with enormous tails like this. Their range of virial parameters is, some of them are quite unbound. Some of them are very bound. They hover around the value of 1, but they're by no means restricted to in this way of in this catalog. Here you can see the time evolution of this from 130, 150 to 200 million years. Clouds supported at this 300 degree temperature. But you see that they develop systematically as they occasionally, maybe five times in a rotation period, encounter one another tidally and bring out these tidal tails shown here. That's right. Everything here is without feedback. We wanted to really get a fix of what is star formation like if there is no feedback as a benchmark to know what we have to explain. Okay. So there's a real interstellar medium in Tasker's galaxy. So the interstellar medium has, it's more complicated than a direct three-phase medium, but it has all those kind of properties that you can look at in our papers, log normal distribution, the density, the PDFs in the different phases. So it has the advantage of a realistic ISM associated with it, if that answers your question.
I was trying to figure out whether, because the hot gas, I assume, is coming from collisions of clouds and processes like that.
Right. So this here, it's by the photoelectric effect from the background. Okay. There's no, the feedback isn't keeping this going from stars, and so it's unrealistic in this way.
What is the collision time scale between clouds? So how does that compare?
About five times per dynamical time scale, sort of.
So it's on the order of the lifetime of like 30 mega years.
Yes. So every kind of a few collisions in the lifetime of a cloud, typically. So it's not growing by agglomeration, but it's an effect. And it's an important effect, as I'll show you in a moment. And so here is the comparison. The reason I showed you the GMC data in the beginning is here is the GMC properties. And red is M33 shown. So this is the cloud mass distribution. And the simulated clouds are here. They go up to 10 to the 7 solar masses. The M33 is here, peaked around 10 to the 6 in a narrow distribution, but they're quite close, really. The three times the galaxy distribution also lies in this regime as well. The radii of the clouds here, we get about 20 parsecs, and that more or less fits. The GMCs in M33 are a bit smaller. That's our best sample because it's about the same spatial resolution we're probing. Here is the range in column densities. We get very large range in here, much larger than is seen for the galaxy, which is about a decade and a half in that survey I've told you about. Very large range in velocity dispersion here, which accounts for the wide range in the virial parameter, which is plotted here. Here's one right here. So a wide range of bound and unbound clouds compared to the galaxy. And this is the virial mass distribution in the simulations in M33 and then in the galaxy. So clearly, you know, the cloud, this is on the right track, but our clouds have overdone it. They've become more massive, they're more stirred, everything that you get if you're not killing the clouds by feedback. Okay?
Maybe I missed this, but how do you define a cloud?
Oh, it's done by, and Elizabeth does it by friends of friends algorithm. The observers use something called clump find, which identifies peaks and valleys and identifying clouds through different observational techniques, a little bit different than the theoretical technique here. But these are very standard techniques. And we use the friends of friends algorithm.
You actually selected them in 3D and not in column density.
We did it in column density. Yeah. So this, I think, is the part that's really robust here. You can ask, and this bears really, maybe if there's one graph I'd like you to remember in this talk, it's maybe this one. Because yes, our clouds are too dense and they're slightly too massive. But what is the rate at which the gas is getting denser? That's the interesting question. So this is in time here, or tens of millions of years. This is the density of 10 to the 4 that we're interested in. Again, the absolute value here is too high. You don't have 20% of your cloud in the terms of this gas. It should be down here. But the rate of growth here coming up, is it about this rate? It is about increase about 3% over 10 million years. But 10 million years is roughly the lifetime of a real molecular cloud if it had everything going on in it killing itself by star formation. So you'd have a star formation efficiency of 3%. if this was just converted to stars. So it's as if the star formation rate you're seeing in a galaxy is just the rate at which that gas is getting dense, is being pushed over the threshold of 10 to the 4 by these gas flows, by this filamentary gas flow that's piling stuff into these dense regions. And the rate at which that is happening is the rate at which you can imagine if this was steady state, you'd be driving the star formation rate. That's our conclusion from the paper. And I think this part is interesting, you know, and is has a longer shelf life. The other part that's interesting is how you're steering the cloud. So as Christoph nicely explained to us in his talk a few days ago, you can look at the spread in the densities, which is defined by log standard deviation in the density, sigma s squared. That's related, of course, to the Mach number of your turbulence, m squared. This relation generally was first found by Padawan, I think, et al., a decade earlier. But there's this parameter, b, which relates to the type of turbulence you have in the cloud. Now, we can calculate that from our data. We could plot this relation. So here's exponential. I mean, you can see what we've done here. So here's m squared versus the exponent. And we can pick off the slope here is the value of b through our data for all of our clouds. And you can see that value is 0.2. Or 0.17. In other words, these clouds, the turbulence has been stirred up presumably by these collisions, or the formation of the cloud and or the collisions it underwent, is about right. Kane, Noonan, and Tan suggested from the observational survey that B was about 0.2.
I think it's important to say, though, that the actual relation that's yellow here also contains a magnetic field.
Yes. Sure.
The factor beta over beta plus 1, where beta is the plasma beta. And so kind of line in that, I'll find B is 0.2, but not if they take into account that actually magnetic fields reduce the sigma s. So in fact, this B they quote as sort of is smaller than it should be.
Okay, because I noticed that other values
sort of fold it into this B. It's not
right.
The kind of B I call.
Okay. But the values are still lower than 1, right?
Yeah.
It's towards the solenoidal.
Right. For that, they actually find something that's more consistent with P of 0.4.
But so I can just say that in this case where it's pure hydro, we get this P. And I would love, and we're hoping to set up simulations where we have galactic magnetic fields involved in the making of the clouds to check all of this. Anyway, I wanted to break and show you a movie of what happens. It's a bit unsettling that we have such low resolution stuff. So what we're doing is we take these clouds and re-simulate in a flash simulation. And I want to show you, I couldn't get this to work inside of the movie. So I wanted to show you what happens to this cloud as it resolves itself under high resolution. There we go. Let me just get this back. But you can see that that big, large region that was just this big blob of 10 to the 4 gas, actually, when you now just take the cloud and, damn it. Sorry for this. Now, so this very blobby region 10 to the 4 starts breaking up under lower temperatures that we put it to, and just let it run here. And you can see what happens is that you get a much finer filamentary structure, of course. The gas is now 10 degrees. There's a few regions. These will be separate star clusters in our calculations, which will ultimately presumably merge. But you start now heading to the scales that Hopkins, et cetera, people are resolving now in this.
Why did you switch to using flash?
Because we have all of our analysis tools in flash, actually. And we ultimately want to put these calculations into flash as well, ultimately. But for the moment, we're just taking our clouds and setting it up in flash and running it there. Flash is where we have MHD running as well and everything else, so.
But extreme transport, the MHD, working in it, so I need to get now. But
yeah.
Not
I know. We're just going to stick with Flash. I mean, Elizabeth is the expert in Enzo, and that's fine, but I don't think we're going to go there. So let me now ask ourselves the question of how would you do the feedback of the radiation field back onto this gas? Now, from the cluster scale back on the galaxy and the GMC. People use a variety of what they call sink particles or star particles. Typically, you put the subgrid there. You say that you have some mass associated with an averaged IMF, as an example. It's like a one-shot at some moment. You pick your IMF, lay it into your clump, and that produces the radiation field. But we wanted to ask a slightly more a next question to this. The clusters are accreting from their surroundings. In accreting, they'll grow, and their luminosity influence on the surrounding gas will be growing with time, over a number of free-fall times internally. What is the process that actually shuts the cluster formation off? If there's no feedback, this will just continue to grow, as you've seen. So the radiation feedback on this scale shuts the accretion flow off to the cluster itself. And that's what we're interested in. So we want to find the time evolution of the radiation field produced by this cluster region. So how would you do that? So what we're going to do is take two things I talked to you about. Take some region, and I say, whatever gas is available, turn 20% of it into stars. The gas that's available is either what I started with, there was some reservoir present, or it's by newly accreted material from outside pouring into this cluster region. Okay? This mimics the efficiency of star formation in your clump. Then convert this to stars, so 20% of the gas available per free fall time. That's how we handle the gas register. And for the stars that you make, we don't have a detailed prescription of how this is divided individual stars. The observations suggest that all the clump, the core mass function is essentially the IMF. So the gas gets partitioned immediately into the IMF. So we draw it random from an IMF to populate the stars that produce in each of these time steps. I don't have time to go to the details here, but you can ask yourself, well, how often do you sample numerically to make sure you converge properly? That's what's done here. If you 100 solar mass clump, 1,000 or 10,000, at different accretion rates, 0 to 10 to the minus 3 solar masses per year in the different colors, then you can see that if you're 1,000 solar masses and you sample maybe 10 times per free fall time, your errors are quite constrained. Okay? In other words, what you're finding through the fluctuations versus what you predict is a small error bar here, which, as you go to higher mass systems, converges even better. So this rule converges numerically and physically quite reasonably.
Just a quick question.
Yeah.
It sounds like you're feeding in this at 20% efficiency.
Yeah.
But shouldn't that be an output of the calculation? And if you put feedback in,
yeah, right.
The accretion grow, and that will determine what the efficiency is, and it won't necessarily come
right
to be the 20%.
So our idea is that once gas gets deep enough into the potential well, it's trapped and stays. The stuff that we're trying to turn around, which you just suggested, the stuff still coming flowing into the region, that's what you feed back on. Once the gas gets dense enough, like all the studies show that in the dense gas, you have this 20% conversion. So that's what this subgrid does. We're just keeping it as 20% of what's available in the subgrid. And the feedback would be everything that's else that's trying to join it. That's the logic.
Well, ideally, you'd like that to be determined, right? You'd like
you
to
would.
Start,
then you'd have to know more.
Yeah. Stop it
yeah.
That's what will shut down star.
Yeah.
You determine that efficiency. And I'm just, it seems odd to me that you, in a calculation where that should be an output, you're putting it in.
You'd have to do more to prescribe your sink particle, obviously, a lot more. You'd almost have to solve the star formation problem, which we're not doing on this scale. Okay? That's the next scale down, where we wouldn't apply such a rule. So then if you go through this a pretty straightforward kind of a model, then, so this is Corey Howard et al., the paper we did last year that was published. Then for no accretion, for 10 to the minus 2, 3 and 10 to the minus 2, you see that the over a number of free fall times, of course, your star formation, the amount of gas in your reservoir just plummets as your stars build up for no accretion. If you're accreting at a modest rate, then of course the star continues to accrete up and it's catching up with the amount of gas available, etc. So you can then check the luminosity of evolution from these models, etc., which we do here. So here are clumps of 100, 1,000, and 10,000 solar masses. Orion sits about here, if you want to focus on that. This is the luminosity, ionization rate, and star formation rate that you predict from this model. The accretion rates, blue is zero accretion, okay? So you just, zero accretion, you just use up the gas here, and the ionizing photon stays fixed. The luminosity comes in this fixed value. Star formation rate decreases with time. No, we're not doing that yet. This is a setup for a subgrid that we'll do on our full 3D simulations. So we're going to take this as our subgrid physics in our next step, okay? Which I'm not doing here. This is just to kind of convince you what happens in this kind of simple way you can figure out almost totally analytically. The ionization rate here. So if you're at the very high accretion rates, of course, your clump mass is always growing. And the ionization rates booms up to 10 to the 51 ionizing photons, et cetera, with time in these time scales.
But again, that's a process that will be pushing back the gas and maybe slowing down.
It will. Yeah.
Yeah.
Precisely. So these calculations are done with just put in a constant accretion rate, and in the real simulation, then it's just fed by whatever the 3D simulation is feeding this cluster sink, exactly. This gives you then an idea of how it's going to respond. But there will be, these will be quite a fluctuating rate, in fact. So this is what it looks like. So what you're sampling is the true IMF, which is in red. And because you're to varying these models, you're varying degrees starved of gas. If you don't have enough of a gas pile here at a model with 100, you're never going to mimic a massive star. But here in the more massive clumps, of course, at 1,000 solar masses, it's still iffy. You still don't have a full sampling of the IMF back from what you started in your sampling law here. Okay? So you get a few O stars, but it isn't fully filled out there as we understand, pretty obviously. But this gives you the clear idea that when you're at 10 to the 4, solar masses and greater as your final mass, then you fully sample the IMF. You have all the O stars there that you expect from the predictions of the IMF. The star formation rates are interesting. So this is the star formation rate here. The series of models, many, many hundreds of calculations are done here. These are the error bars that you get through the statistics shown on each mass point. These are at different times. A freefall time here is about a fraction of a million years. It's 300,000 years in gas that's this dense, okay? 10 to the 4. And you see that the alpha index here measured this straight line slope fit. So our formation rate basically goes as the mass when you do this. So the star formation time scale, the mass divided by your rate, is a constant, which turns out to be 3 million years, which is right on the data, and more captures this modern idea that star formation timescale is a constant on much larger samples of gas. Let's compare that to the data here. So here's the star formation rate per year, plot as a function of mass. Here are models. You fall off that trend when you're too low in mass. You don't capture that. But when you're 1,000 and above, you definitely capture this trend. And this is the data from LADA and LADA plotted here. So it's as if you see this is too high by a factor of perhaps about 3. So that's a prediction. That's what all your feedback has to come up with. Okay. I tried to show you this is a very reasonable model for thinking about how star formation and star formation rates work. And it's just too rich by this factor. So we're expecting, when we put this in a full simulation with radiated feedback, we want to see if this line come down and running through the data. Exactly.
So
yeah.
It's going to go to zero at some point.
Right.
It can't go like that forever.
Yes. So that's kind of now focused where we want to go in the more elaborate simulations. There's predictions here about the number of O stars you expect, et cetera. So do I have 10 more minutes? I think we started late. So my last 15 then, since I'm going to jump on your uncertainty. What about more details on what this feedback, so now let's put feedback into this. What does it do on these cluster scales? Well, we know the answer to this already, part of the answer pretty well, and that is at one level, it's just the thermal energy input. And since Jean's mass goes to T to the 3/2, it's been pointed out by many authors and shown in their simulations. If you have a simulation here of feedback and not feedback here in Krumholtz et al.'s work, then running over time here, where you see fragmentation develop compared to the radiation input, you see there's far less fragmentation because of this scaling. This is a local effect. It's, you know, this is very dense gas. Your radiation field isn't getting out very far in these models. It's kind of a 1,000 AU type of a scale. So it's kind of a local heating effect in that sense. And here's a simulation by Bate et al., which show the same thing, that this radiated feedback, this thermal, just this effect alone, kills off the too abundant formation of brown dwarfs in the Bate and Bunnell simulation, which was just not in keeping with the data at all, but which they now feel, you know, explains the data.
So actually, in that simulation, there's no radiated feeding from the stars. It's purely the difference between an equation of state and solving the radio transfer equation in some approximation. So
yeah.
It's a little bit different than, you know, actually.
Than the actual radio transfer model, yes. Yeah, thanks. Not sure what that is. I think it's from outside. Okay. So here is with some radiative, a combination of radiative transport and MHD. And this is work by Commerson and Peters and others. And I think they're all tending to show this same kind of a trend here, that the suppression with time here of the total mass in cluster in stars here to being suppressed by both radiation and MHD. Now, the thing about MHD I haven't mentioned so far is that you can show on any scale you put it, magnetic fields, because they contribute to the pressure support of the gas, will therefore suppress fragmentation if the magnetic field energy density is comparable to gravitational energy density. If that's not true, if mass to flux is 10, there's not going to be much of an effect here. But if it's around 2, then there will be an effect on that fragmentation. And that would be on any scale, not just this larger scale which people have talked about, but right down into the protostellar disk as well, preventing fragmentation to binaries, as an example. So here is work with Mikhail Klassen now, in which the radiative transfer being done here is done with the ray tracing with Peters et al. Code. This is not the full the radiation transfer code yet, but just to show you what, so this is a region of about 1,000 solar masses, our fiducial median clump that's going to form in Orion. Mass to flux here, very modest. There's a density profile put in here. A word about this. If you don't know this in your star formation community, the profile you put here matters in the abundance of stars formation that you're going to get. The initial conditions, actually, so Bunnell and Bate often have put, just use top hat, flat density profiles. And when you do that, it's homologous collapse. Everything collapses at the same time at a constant density, and you get just star formation that goes bananas. Okay. If you have a tailored profile, this profile you expect in turbulent gas. It's work that McLaughlin and myself and Tan and McKee and others have emphasized in Krumholtz. And so most people, when they model now, use envelopes with power laws like this. And then you don't get so much ramp in star formation. Okay. So initial conditions matter.
Although to be fair, in the other calculations, the Bateman ones don't include turbulent driving.
True.
So there's no additional support either.
That's true. I guess you're right for those, yeah.
Isn't that automatically taken into account by the self-consistent way or transform?
Yeah, in a dynamical simulation, it should be there, like in the simulation I showed you before.
Did they give you that profile?
You know, we haven't checked yet, because we don't have the resolution yet, but that would be very worthwhile.
If you start with a generic turbulent box with gravity, you will eventually get clumps that collapse with that profile.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. And that's kind of an interesting profile. Because it kind of has equal star formation kind of going over all scales. You know, it's not peaked. It's.
And turbulence, we shear also the initial top hat.
Yes. The turbulence will do that, yes. But even then, it still has a memory of that. Because the top hat says everything is a flat, it's a turbulence on top of a flat density. Whereas here, turbulence is going to do that here too, but it's on top of something that's already peaked. And there still is a difference. We check that. Right. I should have referred to them, actually, and I'm sorry that I missed that reference, but they started it, yes. So let's look at a movie, what happens here. This is MHD, then this density profile, and ray tracing. And let's get this formation of the filament gradually. This is a dense region in here where the cluster star. I'm not showing the sink particles. And then gradually you see this radiatively pushed bubble. This is thermal energy being deposited by the ray tracing in here, which is opening up the cavity here. So you see how it's opening up in a direction orthogonal to where the filaments lie. So it's an advantage to a radiation field to do that. And so the structure of this gas matters in what's happened here. The fact it was filamentary, et cetera, provides an easier way of escaping for the radiation field. So here are the magnetic field directions. Here is in the undisturbed part of the cloud. I guess there's some workers out there, so I'm thankful. And with the magnetic field, here's the sense of directions. You see that there are places in the denser gas where you're perpendicular to the filaments. There are places where you're more parallel to the filaments. So as an example here, the more wispy gas is parallel. Whereas in the really dense stuff traced by the L, it does tend to be a little bit more aligned. But we want to do the statistics on these magnetic vectors to understand this. Here in the bubble, you can see that the magnetic field has been pasted into the wall of this bubble here. It's in the shell, wrapping around it like this. Okay. This is my second last slide. This is Helen Kirk's work with us. And this shows you how the filament is actually growing with time. This is a little bit off topic. There isn't radiative feedback in this part of the filament. But this is very exacting work done on our numerical simulations on the data that I just showed you, in which these error bars here are go along and pick out the filament by an algorithm the observers use called disperse. The spine, go perpendicular to that, and then find here, this is over the entire length of filament, the error bars show you the range and the density fluctuations. As you go along the filament and plot this, you get a dispersion around this plot. So that's what's shown in the error bars here. This is for the hydrodynamic simulation, and this is MHD. So this is a fraction of a field of a free fall time. This is about two-thirds of a free fall time of the cloud in this picture here. And you can see that the gas accreting onto the filament, and the filament itself is really starting to run away. It's starting to have this rather peaked profile with the MHD, the magnetic field, providing a pressure in the filament. It's really supporting it. It doesn't get so dense as the, and because of that, it won't fragment as well.
That is the only part of your field lines, actually, that have a component parallel to collapse region, right? If you have basically magnetic fields that are perpendicular, as you showed, there's no increase in pressure.
Well, these are self-gravitating filaments here. So there's always some, it isn't directly perpendicular. There's also some, always some component along the filament, typically. And that's what's providing this. It's not, you know, it's not just like this, but it's like this or like that. And it's that component that's presumably doing this. So there is a pressure support from that. And then finally, this is advertisement. This is for the cutout's work. So this is a now almost completely tested hybrid code. So if you remember Walt Kuiper's talk in the workshop that we had a couple of weeks ago, in which he outlined how he was set up a problem to solve this important problem of how radiation from a central forming massive star feeds back into its surroundings, heats the gas, and perhaps through that radiative feedback shuts off the flow or does something. And several groups are working very hard on this kind of important, because I regard this as the ultimate ground truth of the whole field feedback field, at least in terms of radiation. You need to get a method that you know you're solving your massive star formation problem correctly. If you can do that, then you can start building reliable subgrid models on various scales, I think. But so there's a lot of interest, I think, in this. Anyway, what in the terms of improvements that have been done on Walt Kuiper's code that he used are several. First of all, it's an adaptive mesh, so you can refine in regions where you might be driving out shells, etc., or sweeping up dense gas. That you're not stuck to a fixed source in a fixed grid, but your source can move around inside of this. Very important for cluster formation simulations, multiple sources, etc. You can easily put turbulence into this, etc. So this is the Kuiper and Krumholz problem essentially done. This is a 1,000 AU box, a few solar masses, I forget, about 50 or 100 solar masses put in here. No turbulence, no rotation. So that's already not going to be realistic to not put turbulence in, but it's the way the problem has been set for several codes to examine. These are the density profiles, and this is the temperature of the gas here. High here is this. It's a star is put here. It's a 5,700 degree solar type star, and this is a standard test problem, a disk test problem. Do you heat this radiation field properly? A cold disk here shown in here. So the way that this goes is in the analytic theory of Chang and Goldreich, you would have photons that would heat the upper layer of this flared disk. Then energy would be propagated, this would be absorbed, and propagated downward through this to heat somewhat the midplane. The Piscucci disk recovers this, and it's being taken as the standard test problem for these codes. So it's hard to compare our own numerical resolution with Rolf's in this spherical grid that he used, but this is at a 1 AU resolution here, showing the midplane temperature now. And the Pluto code here has done to match the Monte Carlo simulations very accurately, okay? So this stands for a Monte Carlo simulation with flux, with gray and multi-frequency atmospheres on here. And this is our gray calculation here in the red. So this looks pretty good to us. And
the differences there between the green and the red dots are probably geometry, because
yes.
Wolf's code is spherical.
Agreed. Right. So this passes shock tube tests of various kinds. We can move a particle through the mesh, and things behave properly in terms of radiation field moving along with this particle. So this is very exciting to us, because in this workshop, with experts gathered in these kind of problems, we'll be finishing the writing of this paper and starting our first simulations in real to, first of all, go at this problem that Krumholz and Klein and Kuiper, et cetera, set out. So in conclusion, I tried to show you that, the radiative feedback, at least, certainly occurs at different levels, and there are different kinds of subgrid that we've all talked about here that you might even want to employ for these studies. At the cluster level, we've taken some parts of the star formation inside the cluster sink. We're asking how you shut off the accretion. and what that gradation does to the GM scene beyond. And then in the case of clusters, you're looking at individual sink particles with their own protostellar tracks, their own radiation field, really looking for how the individual stars are going to affect this problem on this cluster level. I think that the geometry of the gas is going to play a very large role in all of this. And I think I'll leave it at that. Thanks very much.
Yeah. Concerning point three that you emphasized a lot in the talk,
yeah.
It seems that, you know, it's so present that those kids from GMC
and individual stars.
So then the general question about the initial conditions of simulations, because small scale simulations are tentative to your less scale or mass, of course, or smaller play stars, if a spherical turbulent whereas what you say, you know, one should actually start from a filamentary initial condition, but it does that on
I think, well, the turbulence will immediately give you filaments. So as long as you put a reasonable turbulent setup in, whatever you start with will mess up immediately into some system of filaments.
But wouldn't you miss larger scale filaments in the wood from the large scale?
Yeah, you would. Well, that's why I think a number of people are trying to simulate GMCs. And the normal simulation that's been done for about a decade is to take a periodic box, you know, a fraction of a parsec, a few hundred solar masses, or a spherical region, as I described here, mess it up with turbulence and let it go. And you close your eyes to what's anything occurring in the larger scale. And that, you know, because of Geohedes and these other studies, that's become uncomfortable, frankly. So, you know, I would say that a few years ago, I would have been, I didn't think so much about galaxy scales, just trying to drill into this kind of a problem, you know, but it's become sort of clear that you have to attach yourself, at least to the GMC, as clear to us as I think it is to galaxy formation people, that you have to attach yourself to the GMC too. It's a self-gravitating entity that has these scaling laws. That is what's independent of the galaxy and the surrounding. It's the GMC, apparently. Wherever you look, you see the same scaling, whether you're in massive galaxies or not. You know, it's just the way self-gravity works on that scale. And I think that has to be the arena. And that will solve this. So your cluster is a point, you know, one parsec region inside this 20 parsec filamentary region.
One comment on geometry here is that it's very dramatic, the filaments, and I can see why you're focused on them, but of course the gravitational field will not have the same degree of elongation, so the gravitational field will be rounder than the mass,
right,
which gives rise to by a factor of about 3 or so. So to the extent that the dynamics is driven by the gravity, that will behave more like a spherical cloud than your pictures of the density would suggest.
It's true. So there, if you plot the gravitational potential that is all occurring, it is much more symmetric, of course. And your filaments will be, you know, these streams and such. So no doubt that's that potential that's helping draw the gas in, but they are going in along the filaments.
So the ability to get rid of the gas, you know, which is kind of large about potential, that may be less geometry dependent than material flowing mm-hmm. in to build up the cluster in the first place.
Yeah, could be. Christoph?
In your comparison of star formation rate versus cloud mass with lava as well.
Yeah.
You had a bunch of data points that you produced. Can you explain again what actually went into this? I couldn't really follow where this. Simulation, or is this
no. So this is from the simulation. I hope you understand these lines here, the blue. Okay, so for each mass scale that we did, as I showed you in the previous slide, so that went too quickly then. So here are different clumps. We just set up a different clump, and here's from 1 to 10 to the 5 solar masses. No, just by this rule, you feed an accretion rate in, you convert so many percent per free fall time to the star. It's not a hydrodynamical simulation.
Okay, so it is a statistical
It's a semi-analytic calculation, right? Okay? That's the point. Whereas the data are, of course, real. Those are from real clouds done up to 10 to the 4, almost 10 to the 5 solar masses. And LADA uses this to connect local star formation processes to galactic ones. And it's very much this, the whole spirit of what we're trying to do here. Is that clear? Well, thanks very much. I put a lot of MHD on this because I hope there's food for thought for next Thursday in our discussion session when we'll talk about MHD.